Welcome back again to BadQuaker.com. This is podcast number 62 for Tuesday, December 13th, 2011. My name is Ben Stone. Thank you again for tuning in to BadQuaker.com, whether you're listening to me on the Liberty Radio Network or whether you're listening on iTunes. Be sure and get over to BadQuaker.com website. You'll find all the links to each day's shows there, and you'll find the archives. All you have to do is scroll down, and on the right-hand side, you'll find categories that you can search by, or you can go on further, and you can find our archives and search month by month and get back there and hear some of the earlier stuff that was not broadcast on the Liberty Radio Network. Now, today, once again, Brad Jardis is with us. Oh, look at that. I'm looking at the website, and I spelled his name wrong last week. How terrible. I'm going to have to get with the admins and get that fixed. Anyway, Brad Jardis is with us again today on interview follow-up. Well, actually, I recorded this yesterday on Monday. Today, Tuesday, he's going to be in court fighting the injunction. What was it called? Whatever that thing was that the university put against him. Restraining order. There we go. Today, Tuesday, he's in court fighting the restraining order. So the interview that I recorded with him yesterday is what you're going to hear in just a couple of minutes. Now, I'm not going to waste any more time. Let's just get right into the interview and take off. And here's the interview with Bradley Jardis. Excuse me. This is Ben back with you at BadQuaker.com, and once again, I'm talking to Bradley Jardis. If you're not familiar with this situation up in New Hampshire at the Plymouth State University, rather than me wasting the time to explain it, just click the links at BadQuaker.com or listen to what we're talking about and catch up with us, because there's really too much to even recap in 2 or 3 minutes. Bradley, thanks again for coming on the show with me, and why don't you give us an update on everything that's going on?
Of course, Ben. I thank you again for drawing attention to this important issue. Essentially, what has been going on up here in New Hampshire is, since 2003, there's been a law that says that political subdivisions can't regulate firearm ownership, possession, sale, and that also includes ammunition and knives. And the university system of New Hampshire has had these regulations that violate this specific state law, and I would also say violate the Constitution up here, Article 2-A, regarding the right to keep and bear arms. And a friend of mine, Tommy Mazingo, and I decided that we wanted to enhance self-defense freedom for all students, visitors, and faculty of the university system. So we decided to call attention to their illegal regulations and try to get them to back down or to, you know, say, admit that they are subservient to the New Hampshire General Court. So I announced, I believe it was actually a week ago, that we were going to do a protest, more of like an information distribution at Plymouth State College in Plymouth, New Hampshire. And we throughout the week, spoke with the Vice President for Student Affairs and the University System of New Hampshire General Counsel about what we were planning to do, and both of them, they really didn't want us to do it. They thought it was a threat to public safety, and they really blew it way out of proportion. They actually went out and got a restraining order against us in the Grafton County Superior Court, and we have a hearing tomorrow at 2:30 p.m. On the merits of the restraining order, because it's restricting our liberties. And the restraining order essentially said that we are forbidden from carrying firearms onto University System of New Hampshire property. And in effect, the restraining order turns illegal regulations into criminal contempt of court. So we went on Friday to Plymouth State University, and we went unarmed. We obeyed the court order, although we firmly disagree with it. And we had a really good outreach event where we spoke to lots of students and talked about self-defense rights and basically how the only people who are going to be affected by these regulations or or who are affected by these regulations are the people who you'd want to have carrying a gun in the first place because they're not criminals. And we left, and now we are waiting for our hearing, which is tomorrow at 2:30. We've got several members of the New Hampshire General Court, the legislature up here, who are supporting us, and we're going to be submitting a letter to the court from a member of the New Hampshire General Court, which, you know, it's called the General Court, but it's actually the legislature, essentially saying that the court overstepped its authority, that the university system isn't respecting state law, and that according to state law, people have the right to possess firearms to defend themselves. So our hearing is tomorrow, and it's going to cost us about $1,500 to prosecute the initial stages of this appeal. And we're trying to do our best to get donations to help us fight for firearm and self-defense freedom here in New Hampshire. And if any of your listeners would like to help us, we would be very humbled by that. You can actually find we have a chip-in, which makes it very easy to donate $5 or $10. And we're up to about $500 now, so we need to come up with $1,000 more to fight this injunction. And you can find the chip-in at www.freekeene.com, F-R-E-E-K-E-E-N-E.com. And it should be still on the first page there. But so that's what we've been working on. And like when we spoke before, we still feel very strongly about this, and we want very much for self-defense rights to be respected up here in New Hampshire.
Now, I should point out that we're not talking about lunatic fringe group here. Bradley, you spent 11 years as a police officer in New Hampshire, and you're a lifetime New Hampshire resident. So, and we're not talking about some lunatic in a cave in Montana somewhere. We're talking about you have never been convicted of a crime. You don't even have, like, traffic problems or anything like that. Is that right?
Yeah, I kept repeating that. I feel kind of silly saying it over and over again, but I think it's important to point out I've never even been convicted of a parking ticket. And to tell you the truth, I personally don't even own a firearm, which many of my friends were surprised when I told them that. You know, when I was a police officer, I certainly carried off duty and carried on duty. But right now, you know, I'm not a hunter, and I'm not really too interested in target shooting right now. But what I am interested in is enhancing self-defense freedom for people who have the legal, statutory, constitutional, and natural right to defend themselves. And, you know, bureaucrats have been getting away with taking freedoms away for far too long, so I decided to, with Tommy, the two of us would sort of take the fight to their doorstep.
Now, I'd like to kind of make a challenge here. If you consider thinking back to the Keller decisions in Washington, D.C. in reference to gun rights, there was some serious pro-gun money that came in like a storm and helped out the people that were fighting for their rights in Washington, D.C. in the Keller decision. And at this point, any of those people could step in. We're talking about any of the large-scale gun rights organizations that are so prominent on the Internet and that are always announcing how they're always fighting for gun rights. Maybe if they were spending a little less money on, on lobbyist dinners and a little bit more on actually fighting in the trenches like this, perhaps more people would be able to go out and give a serious challenge to these gun laws.
I'm doing everything I can to sort of get the message out there, and we're taking all the risk and the time to have this battle. But financially speaking, these things aren't cheap. The university system of New Hampshire certainly has quite a legal budget to use, to fight against their authority being taken away. Authority, by the way, that they've never had, and. So it's easy for them, and we're sort of like the little guy. But they really helped us out by going and getting this injunction, because when they got that injunction, it in effect gave us a hearing within 7 days, because it was issued what's called ex parte, and that means without all parties involved. So the university. City System of New Hampshire in their filing in the court, they essentially said that, you know, they've been given broad authority to ensure academic excellence and to make sure that academic excellence is by external sources. And the problem with that argument is that if you read New Hampshire RSA 159.26, and that's 159:26, it says that only the general court can control firearms, ammunition, firearm components, or firearm supplies or knives unless they specifically authorize by statute. So in New Hampshire's university system laws, which is chapter 187A, there is no mention of the word firearm, knives, ammunition, firearm components, firearm supplies, or knives, and that means that they don't have the specific authority to do what they've been doing. And I think they know it. I mean, the judge, I honestly can't really fault the judge too much for issuing the temporary restraining order, because if you think about it, here come these university officials saying, oh my God, there's going to be a mass terrorist attack of all these people carrying guns. And unfortunately, that's sort of how responsible gun owners are viewed,
right,
by the media and the really far left. You know, and gun owners are some of the most law-abiding good people I've ever known in my life. And one thing I always would do when I would pull over a car for like a traffic offense, and ever so often I'd pull somebody over and they'd hand me their pistol permit and their pistol license. Mm-hmm. And I would always say to them, I would say, hey, if you saw me on the side of the road getting the beat out of me, would you stop and help? And they said, absolutely. You know, every single time. I don't remember once where someone didn't say absolutely.
Right, right.
Firearm owners are a benefit to society because they keep communities safe. I mean, these are people who care about their safety, who care about the safety of their community, and the world would be a far better place if all good people owned and carried firearms, because criminals would be far outnumbered, and anyone who tried to pull any criminal activity would be facing down the barrel of polite society, so to speak.
I don't know if a lot of law enforcement really realize this, but you hit on something there that's really important to emphasize. If you go on the internet and you get on a lot of gun forums and hunting forums and that type of places on the internet, what you'll find is some almost fanatically pro law enforcement individuals that are very quick to defend law enforcement. They're not the radical law enforcement bashers out there. Oftentimes, now I'm not saying that everybody who owns a gun loves all police. That's not what I'm saying. But what I'm saying in general, as a general statement, there's a lot of pro-law enforcement feeling among gun owners, and I'm not really sure law enforcement realize they have that kind of support among that group of people.
Well, I mean, there are many in law enforcement, typically in the higher echelons of law enforcement, that have sort of an elitist attitude, like, you know, only we should have the guns. I mean, a good example is the state of Illinois, the state of Massachusetts, Maryland, New Jersey, and, you know, it's really sad because the government is supposed to work for the people, and our rights are supposed to be unalienable, and unfortunately, because of politically connected attorneys getting appointed to the Supreme Court, the rights, which you know, nowhere in the U.S. Constitution does it say that rights can be reasonably restricted, but yet that's what happens. You know, oh yeah, here and there, you know, whittle away just a little bit, a little bit, a little bit, and then eventually, you know, there's a great saying from World War II. I believe it was Pastor, I can't think of his name, but it was, first they came for the communists, and I wasn't a communist, so I didn't do anything, you know, and then they came for the trade unionists, and I wasn't a trade unionist, so I didn't do anything, and mm-hmm. It goes on, and then eventually, and then they came for me, and there was no one left to stand up for me, and that's how I feel about this, because firearm ownership is very important to a free society.
Yeah, and that's really something that we're very close to losing here. I don't really realize. I'm sorry, I said that backwards. I don't think most people realize, even gun owners, you know, how how threatened these things are, because we always talk about the creeping socialism, and we always talk about how, you know, the gun rights are being eroded, and we're talking about slippery surface, and we use all this terminology, but I don't really think we realize how these things are slipping away. All you really have to do is look at how the imports of ammunition and the imports of military surplus arms have been cut back in the last 10 years. 10 years ago, you could buy a Yugoslavian SKS for, like, you know, $60 or something like that. That's not the case now.
No, it's in large part because of just absolutely ridiculous groups like the Brady Campaign and... It's just amazing that, I mean, there's so many smart people that just don't get it. Like, when I was at Plymouth State University, I was saying to a group of students, look, this isn't about me, this is about you, and don't give your rights away, because if you do, the absolute ridiculousness of believing that gun regulations do anything to criminals is just insane. Criminals don't care what the law says, and the only people who typically do are the people who you'd want to have guns in the first place. And, like, this logic makes such sense to me and probably to you and probably to your listeners, but unfortunately, like, people think, oh, you can write some words down on paper, pass a law, make a decree, enact a regulation, and then places are going to be safe. And that's just ridiculous. It's contrary to reality.
It really is. It's beyond naive to think that, that a criminal is about to take a criminal act. He's about to do something that we all recognize as being criminal, and all of a sudden it dawns on him, oh, man, they just passed a law against that.
I don't have a pistol permit. I can't do that.
Yeah, I guess I won't knock off that liquor store now that it's illegal.
No, yeah, exactly. It comes down to the government wanting to control people, the government not wanting people to be able to defend themselves, the government wanting people to rely on them for self-protection, and it's really sad. Like, to me, like, I sort of just feel very, very unfortunate about the fact that there's all these young adults, these young adults at Plymouth State University, who believe that their own rights to defend themselves should be taken away. And, you know, when they do that, they just don't, I don't think they're seeing the big picture that, you know, when you do that, the only person who's getting hurt is them. I mean, they're hurting themselves because even if they don't want to carry a gun, right now I choose not to carry a gun. I might buy one in the near future, but, you know, I mean, I hang out with lots of friends who do carry guns. And I'll tell you right now, any criminal who would be planning on doing something untoward or illegal or immoral, they would think twice before coming after me or my group of friends, because they know, you know, we have a lot of firearms, and we are responsible people, mm-hmm. and we will not be victimized.
Well, that kind of reminds me of my olden days back in, you know, I used to hang around with a lot of biker types out in California back in the late 70s and so forth, and almost all of them, to a man, were armed in one sense or another, and they were unbelievably polite. It didn't matter what was going on, they were just a very, very polite group of people. And the last thing a person would want to do is to wander into a group of, you know, 50 or 75 bikers and try to start trouble, because, it's just a very unhealthy.
Oh, yeah. I love bikers. I mean, they typically are very, very libertarian. I mean, of course, there are some biker groups that, you know, do some crimes that are certainly.
Sure.
Have no place in society, but for the large part, they just want to be left alone. And, myself being very, very small L libertarian, I believe in pretty much the whole Quaker philosophy, you know, respect people's choices and don't hurt anybody.
I appreciate you bringing that up. Also, I wanted to give you one more chance to let people know that in case somebody comes in a little late into the show, that this is not being funded by any kind of big money. You don't have any kind of big, you know, any big magazines supporting you or any big gun organizations. And every little $2 or $5 or $15 donation really says a lot. It really has a bigger impact than maybe a, you know, a membership to some organization that's going to buy a lobbyist.
Yeah, so, I mean, if any of your listeners can help us, I mean, again, if you send us $5 or $10, that would be huge, because it all adds up, and, you know, we want to do you proud, we want to do all your listeners proud, and we want to let the government know that it's unacceptable at any level to restrict self-defense freedom. And, you know, I'm sure the university system of New Hampshire is saying, you know, why us, you know, and why is this happening to us? And, you know, more than just enhancing firearm freedom in this one location, it is important to let the state know that we, the people, will not stand to be disarmed. We will not stand to have our rights infringed upon, and we will not stand to be put in unsafe situations. So any effort that the state makes to try to restrict firearm freedom, I think we all need to band together, and we all need to put some skin in the game, so to speak, to make sure that the state knows that it's just not acceptable.
Well, I have you on the line. If you have just a moment longer, let's give a shout out to the Free State Project in general, and to FreeKeen.com and all the folks up there that are doing a great job at trying to bring liberty into New Hampshire.
Yes, thank you very much for bringing that up. The Free State Project, which you can find at freestateproject.org, is an organization which essentially is designed to keep New Hampshire awesome, because New Hampshire has a long, proud history of, our motto is live free or die, and the boots-on-the-ground activism for fighting back against the police state is happening right here in New Hampshire, and the Free State Project, I believe, is the solution to having liberty in our lifetime. And there's just so many great activists here in New Hampshire, and we're all working together to make sure that the state leaves you alone to lead your life how you see fit, so long as you don't hurt anybody else. And that, to me, is the only moral way to live your life.
Now, one other thing, too, I think I just said one other thing, so here's one other thing. But some people might be a little hesitant about New Hampshire in the winter. Can you tell us a little of your opinion about New Hampshire in the winter? Because I know a lot of people just think of it as like, you know, as like the Yukon or something. But really, New Hampshire has a fairly wide variation between the mountains and the valleys and the coastline.
Well, New Hampshire's climate is very, very strange. In the summertime, it'll be 105 degrees out with humidity that when you step outside, it hits you like a wall. And then in the wintertime, it can get down to negative 10, you know, with a blizzard and a snowstorm and just crazy. Last night, I went out to see a movie with one of my friends, and I was wearing sandals that I had bought in Hawaii like a year ago, and it was like 20 degrees out. And she was like, "How can you wear sandals?" And I was like, "Well, I was born and raised here. You know, this isn't too bad. Like 20 is like 60 degrees for me. You know, for people who move here. But you know, it's a small price to pay for living with people who think like you. Like the second you move here from wherever you come from, you'll find that there'll be 20 to 30 people ready to help you move into wherever you're moving to, you know, and all those people want is to shake your hand and eat some pizza and drink a few beers. So just supply with pizza and beer, and you've got like an instant family waiting for you here. And you know that everyone thinks like you, and everyone is, everyone just wants to live in a society where they're just left alone, and the government just leaves them alone to live how they see fit. And this New Hampshire, I believe, is the solution to the police state problem and the problem of overreaching and over-intrusive government. And I would just really, really reach out to everybody to ask them to go to freestateproject.org and come up here and help us keep New Hampshire awesome.
I want to thank you again, Bradley, for coming on the show with me. Is there anything else you wanted to add to that?
No, no. Thank you very much, Ben, and I'm happy to come on your show anytime, especially if you'd like me to come back and talk about our court case. And we're really hoping we win tomorrow, so everyone please cross your fingers for us.
I wish you all the best on that, and yeah, we definitely want you to come back on the show and give us an update on that. You're around here at the Bad Quaker compound. We're all abuzz with all the activity up there, so we're waiting on pins and needles to find out.
Awesome.
Thanks a lot, Bradley.
Thanks, Ben.
Okay, now that was the interview with Bradley Jardis that I did yesterday. As I mentioned, today he is in court. If you can, get over to badquaker.com and click on the links and follow those links over to freekeen.com. And if any way that you can help Brad, if you can help Bradley out in any way with the legal funding on this, with his attorney fees, and he's going to have court costs, and he's going to have all this stuff. Remember, he has no big-time financial support. This is just Bradley and Tommy out there fighting for your rights. They're working on a shoestring budget. If you can afford to stop by Freekeen and push the little button there and drop them $5, $10, if you can afford $20, fantastic. You know, if you're in a position where you can afford more, then please do that, because they have absolutely no big time backing. They have if you're listening to my voice and you have some connection with one of these large gun rights organizations or one of these large liberty-minded organizations, take a moment and contact whoever you have to contact and explain to them the gravity of this situation and the importance that these guys get funding and that they're able to pay their legal bills so that they can fight this thing, because they're up there at Plymouth State University fighting for your rights. That's what they're doing. And if you can afford to push that button and drop them a few dollars, then please do so. Now, since the recording, since the interview fell short of our time frame, what I have decided to do for you is I'm digging up our most popular podcast of all time. This was an audio article that I did some time back about Washington, D.C.'s war against Mexico. I'll bet you didn't know that Washington, D.C. has been at war against Mexico, but they have been, and they have been for quite some time. And so listen to this article. This, like I said, this is the most popular article that BadQuaker.com has ever published. And give a listen to it, and I think you'll see why it's the most popular article. Thank you very much, folks. Washington, D.C.'s War on Mexico. Frederick Bastiat, That Which Is Seen and That Which Is Not Seen. In the economy, an act, a habit, an institution, a law, gives birth not only to an effect, but a series of effects. Of these effects, the first only is immediate. It manifests itself simultaneously with its cause. It is seen. The others unfold in succession. They are not seen. Between a good and a bad economist, this constitutes the whole difference. The one takes account of the visible effect. The other takes account of both of the effects which are seen and also those which it is necessary to foresee. Now this difference is enormous, for it almost always happens that when the immediate consequence is favorable, the ultimate consequence is fatal. I was reading a story on a liberal website about how corn subsidies lower the market price on a variety of junk foods, therefore making them more cost-effective for poor people to purchase. The result being that the poorest people in the U.S. eat the most unhealthy foods, while the more affluent can afford healthy alternatives. Of course, the author, being a liberal statist, was only noticing one tiny suction cup of the massive tentacle of U.S. farm subsidies that distort the market and ruin people's lives around the world. But sadly, as I read his article, I couldn't help noticing the implied solution was to simply subsidize good food while bringing down the hammer of regulation on bad food. This tendency of willful ignorance and blind support of the expansion of the state is not unique to liberals. For every one liberal that I have struggled with trying to show them that their state god is incapable of fixing the problems it creates, I have wrestled with 10 conservatives trying to show them that brute force and more laws will only grow the state and drive taxes and spending higher. If I could say it clearer than Bastiat, I would, but whether in his words or mine, the majority of the time, the sound of my voice is lost in the roar of the state's propaganda, driving the liberal towards more nanny regulations and driving the conservative to get tough. A typical hot button with a conservative is the illegal immigration issue. At the mere mention of the topic, the whole right wing explodes into rhythmic chants demanding tougher laws and brutal crackdowns. Speak of crime, gangs, or the drug problem, and the state's faithful congregation will leap to their feet in open praise of the stronger fist and the heavier boot. Sadly, the logic of cause and effect are swept to the side as emotions of nationalism take the pulpit. The fact that the state created the problem completely escapes the glare of the limelight as reason slips off the stage and out the side door. Corn is just the beginning. I wonder if the average reader of this article knows that because of U.S. corn subsidies, the price has fallen by 2/3 in the last 20 years. Generally, I'm all for lower prices, but when a government involves itself in a market so dramatically as to create such false prices, you can bet there will be huge repercussions in unimaginable places. But corn is just the beginning. The price of sugar is just as false, but manipulated in the opposite direction. And neither corn nor sugar can hold a light for the price manipulation that the rice market suffers. The reader may be wondering at this point why I'm bouncing from crime, gangs, drugs, and immigration to left-right politics and farm subsidies. Well, I'm not bouncing. They are all the same thing. Remember those faithful words of Bastiat about the seen and the unseen. The very reason governments should stay out of markets is because they are incapable of connecting the dots and seeing the association between their actions and the consequences of those actions. But I'm here for you, my reader, with a big black marker to show you how these dots connect. You see, the poor farmers of Mexico used to feed their families by growing 3 money-making crops: corn, rice, and sugar. Then the intellectuals in their ivy-covered universities decided that the standard of living in rural Mexico was too low, and the farmers needed to stop farming and move into Mexican cities where they can work in low-end manufacturing. So at the same time the U.S. ratcheted up its price manipulations with farm subsidies, NAFTA opened Mexico to a flood of corn that the farmers couldn't compete against. And yet, restrictions kept Mexican rice and sugar from flowing north. Imagine yourself a Mexican farmer, just getting by on a living you scratch from the ground in fields your family has tilled longer than there is memory to tell. Then the weak, corrupt government in Mexico City makes a deal with the strong, corrupt government in Washington, D.C., and your only source of livelihood is gone. The way your family has lived for centuries is taken away by people whose faces you have never seen and names you have never heard. That farmer has choices. 1. Starve and watch his children starve on the farm. 2. Move to a dangerous slum in a Mexican city where the language is so different he almost can't communicate, and hope he can find work. 3. Take a chance, sneak into the U.S. where work is available, and the cities are magic wonderlands compared to the Mexican slums. 4. Grow something profitable. To fully understand point 4, let me restate my accusation that the government in Mexico City is corrupt and weak. So corrupt and weak that it can't even provide security for those living in its cities, much less control the countryside. This is actually one of the great strengths of the Mexican culture. Once you get away from the government's influence and are submerged in the colorful freedom that rural Mexico affords, it's much easier to fall in love with the Mexican people and understand the depths of the tragedy that has befallen them. So in the past, a weak government was a good thing for rural Mexico. But since the U.S. war on drugs has driven so much wealth in the hands of crime lords, the weak government that used to technically exist in rural Mexico is gone, leaving the armies and private security of the drug lords. And they don't care about the price of corn. So the farmer that chooses to stay in his farm is told in terms he cannot misunderstand that his only path to security and prosperity is to grow the crop that the drug lord tells him to grow. Then, when the harvest is in, the sergeants of the drug lords pick villagers who take the risk and act as human mules carrying the drugs across the border while knowing that if they refuse or fail, their families will bear the punishment. Jumping back to point three above, you can see that the U.S. farm subsidies created a large segment of the illegal immigration problem. With a glance at point two above, you may notice that the increase in the labor pool in Mexican cities drove the local wages down and attracted U.S. manufacturers to move jobs out of U.S. cities and into Mexico, thus devastating whole neighborhoods in Detroit, Chicago, Cleveland, and the list goes on. Now that I've removed the bandages that have hidden the wound that Washington, D.C. afflicted upon gentle villagers and farmers in Mexico, bear with me as I reveal yet more injustices. You see, some of those farmers who left their family land had to sell that land right at a time when there was a glut of Mexican farms available on the market. However, a buyer appeared, not a person, but an invention of the state. Multinational agribusiness swept in and gobbled up the choice farms at pennies on the dollar, driving even more Mexican farmers out of business. And if all of the above weren't enough, in the same time frame, 80 to 90% of the water of the Colorado River that used to go into Mexico was diverted, and the river no longer even comes close to reaching the sea, leaving whole towns in the Delta abandoned. Of course, growing cities in the U.S. needed that water for important things like fountains and magic volcanoes and gondola rides in Las Vegas and the expanses of golf courses in Scottsdale and Palm Springs. But don't think that water was all wasted on fun things the poor Mexicans can't even imagine exist. Have a drive into California's Imperial Valley, where old, leaky, broken canals carry that water from the Colorado River into alfalfa fields. And you'll see why it was necessary to dry up the River Delta and force the Cocopah Indians off their ancestral lands. It's true that some of that water makes its way to Los Angeles and supports the residents. But those residents pay a 4,600% higher price than the agribusiness alfalfa growers. And what happens to all that alfalfa? The vast majority goes to the heavily subsidized U.S. dairy industry, where a USDA cartel markets its products with fixed prices and government-guaranteed purchases, eliminating its competition at the point of the state's gun. Let me recap this article just for kicks and giggles. Traditional Mexican farmers supported themselves by growing corn, rice, and sugarcane. The state has systematically manipulated the price and controlled the distribution of corn, rice, and sugar, practically eliminating the ability of Mexican farmers to continue their traditional lifestyle and making many of them slaves of the drug lords. The state's war on drugs has enriched drug lords, enabling them to become a virtual state in northern Mexico. NAFTA's attempt to enrich the lives of Mexican farmers, whether they wanted it or not, by driving them into the cities, resulted in both job losses in U.S. cities and an increase in illegal immigration into the U.S. With an increase flow of illegal immigration into ever poorer U.S. cities and richer, more powerful drug lords funneling drugs through the gangs into those cities, crime results. Multinational agribusiness not only absorbs massive amounts of tax dollars through direct subsidies and state price controls, it also expands itself by scooping up cheap land as family farmers are squished. Agribusiness, along with international gaming companies and city governments, along with their crony golf buddies, steal water from some of the poorest people in the Western Hemisphere so they can offer such niceties as artificially priced state-regulated gelato vodka smoothies to tourists who stare drunkenly at a fake pyramid. Oh, and we're supposed to believe this is capitalism. Having considered all of the above, I have to wonder, how long will it be before the wise overlords in Washington, D.C. decide the Mexican government has failed, and the U.S. military once again sweeps into Sonora and Chihuahua, and Marines once more march into the halls of Montezuma. For more articles and podcasts on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. And thank you for listening.